Good morning, everybody. My name is Ray Vowell, and I'm an alcoholic. As I stand here looking out into the 30,000 faces, now that doesn't mean anything at all to you, but can you imagine how that's going to sound on this tape when I take it back to Hogansville, Georgia? You see, all these other speakers, they come down here and speak, and they go back, and they got honest jobs. I got to compete with Billy Graham and Oral Roberts and all these other guys, you know. And it's not easy. Yeah. I have this one overpowering fear in my life, and that is that the church that I pastor will find out for the amount of money they pay me they could get a real preacher. It's good to be with you. I apologize for the disparaging remarks that all the other speakers made about the name Sawiga. I knew what Sawiga meant. I went to high school with her. I really like that old girl. I do want to express my appreciation to the committee for inviting us. And this is not the first time that I've been to Albany. It's the first time I've stopped. But I've really enjoyed it. It's been great. I don't tell funny stories. Because I'm serious. You know, my profession is serious. I apologize to you for not being able to dance last night, but we don't do that. I don't know why the others don't do it. I can't. You see, we don't even make love standing up. We're afraid somebody think we're dancing. I might as well get it out of the way since this seems to be the morning for confession. W.H. waited till just before I got up to tell me that he was a Baptist preacher. Now, he's not one of our kind. He's a primitive Baptist preacher, and that intrigues me. I've always wondered, I don't even know what I am, but it would be easier for me to find out what you are than it would to find out what I am. See, I don't know what primitive means, but it sounds interesting. Somebody told me when they said, what kind of preacher are you? And I said, I'm a Southern Baptist. He said, well, I'm an independent. I said, well, I guess we are too. Y'all come over to our church sometime. So like I said, it's confession time. I don't mind admitting that I am a Baptist preacher. I'm a Southern Baptist preacher. I went to a Southern Baptist seminary. I pastor a Southern Baptist church in Hogansville, Georgia. And I'm no more ashamed of that than I am being an alcoholic. They're both incurable. You have to learn to live with them. Somebody came up to me up in Owensboro, Kentucky, a few months ago and said, how can you call yourself a preacher? And I said, well, I usually don't. I don't remember ever going up and saying to somebody, hey, I'm a preacher. I said, some other folks call me preacher. That doesn't necessarily mean that I am either. I've been called some things I don't think I really am. For one thing, I've been down to the courthouse and checked. My mom and daddy is married. You know? I was beginning to doubt there for a while, you know. And he said, the way you talk, how could you consider yourself a preacher? And I said, well, let me ask you something. You know one thing about the Bible? And he said, yeah. I said, you know anything about Jesus? He said, yes. I said, when Jesus spoke to the shepherd, what did he talk about? He said things like, who among you having one sheep, 100 sheep and one be lost, would not go out to find it? He talked about sheep herding, didn't he? He said, that's right. So when he talked to farmers, he said, you know, and one cast his seed upon the rocky soil and one upon the sandy soil and one upon the fertile soil. I said, talk about farming, didn't he? He said, yeah. I said, when he talked to fishermen, he talked about casting your nets out into the deep. Then he said, yeah, that's right. I said, when you talk to alcoholics, you might as well talk about alcoholism, because they don't know nothing else. So, you know, really that's what I've come for this morning is to share with you about alcoholism. Now, the only authority that I have this morning about alcoholism is my own personal experiences. And one thing I found out years ago, that you cannot tell an alcoholic they have to do anything, because they will immediately set out to prove to you they don't. So, you know, we don't have a lock on this thing, folks. I know that the kind of people you hang out with, you think the whole world's kind of dingy, because you sit around in rooms like this with folks like these other folks, and they all act dingy. And you finally get, you know, I feel that way at church. A lot of times, you know, you said something about they need something different. They do, and I wish I could figure out what it is. But I am personally convinced, as I stand here this morning, that God has a very, very special place in His heart for alcoholics, and especially recovering alcoholics. You see, this country suffers from a grave disease called Moorism. Ted talked about it last night. And he talked about, you know, this one thing, this more, and that's the way we are. We're compulsive. You know, I never wanted one of anything in my whole life. I never took a girl home from a high school date because I wanted all of them. And by the time I made my choice, somebody else already had them. You know, I can't go to Davis Brothers or Watts or, you know, any of these fancy cafeterias, because there's nothing on there that looks bad. You know, you start down that line and then they put the dessert first. Now, you know that's a psychological trick. Now, how many of you ever go to the table to eat at home and your wife puts your dessert on the plate first? And then they put all this stuff, you know. And, you know, they can make the most ridiculous food look good. I hate broccoli. But when you cover it and make it yellow, who knows? So, you know, I think that God knew. I've been trained to believe God knows everything. And so if he knows everything, he knew that eventually we're going to have a meeting down here in Albany. And we're going to get together and I was going to have to tell you this. I don't believe that at all. Somebody asked me, said, well, does God know everything? I said, well, I don't think so. Now, this is paraphrasing by Ray Bowell. This is not from the gospel according to anybody except me. But I don't think God bothers himself with little tiny details. I hope you didn't know what I did last night. The guy said, well, one of my theological brain brothers came at me and he said, you said God doesn't know everything. I said, I don't believe he does. He said, well, you don't tell me things like that unless you can support it theologically. Well, see, I'm a doctor. I can do that. One of the advantages of having a PhD is you don't have to know nothing. You can just say it, and other folks have to prove it's not right. There are three students this month at Pepperdine University writing antithesis to a thesis that I wrote last summer at Southwestern Seminary trying to prove something that I said was wrong. It probably was. I don't know. Because what I basically said was about what I'm fixing to say to you, that God has an understanding and a special love in His heart for people who are in pain. And I can prove that God likes alcoholics better than other folks because He knows what we need and He gives it to us. He knows that we need more. He gave the whole world 10 commandments. Gave us 12 steps. He knew we wouldn't be satisfied with everybody else. So, you know, I grew up, you know, thinking that things, I always thought the clergy was really set apart, you know. You know, I always thought that they put those guys that they preach on Sunday and they put them in a deep freeze for Wednesday night. Well, a lot of them preach on Wednesday night, they act like that's where they've been all week. I found out the preachers are pretty human. They won't let you be much of anything else, folks. I visited in a home not too long ago. There was three little old ladies that lived together. I used to call them little old maids, but I've been told by an owl of mine that they're called single by choice. Now, I don't know whose choice, but I don't believe it was none of these little old ladies' choice, because... You know, you let somebody, you let a woman die in our church and the man have to wear armor. I mean, you know, the widower gets to church and they ask him, you know. They say, well, I don't have any need for a man. I said, well, why do you keep grabbing that one during church? You know, I mean, so I'm visiting these little old ladies and they asked me if I'd like some refreshments and I didn't want to hurt their feelings. So they went in to fix some cake and coffee, and there was a bowl of peanuts sitting on the table, and I reached over and got a handful and ate them, and they still wasn't back, so I reached over and got another handful, and being compulsive the way I am and never having had all I want of anything, before they got back, before I knew it, I had eaten every peanut in that bowl. It was kind of embarrassing. Lady came back and she said, oh, I see you found the peanuts. And I said, yes, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to eat all of them. She said, well, that's all right. She said, since I had my teeth pulled, I can't do nothing but suck the chocolate off of them. W.H. didn't want me to tell this, but I really think in the interest of honesty and disclosure, why, someone told me that he was visiting two little ladies about like the three that I was visiting. And they were sitting there having tea and tea cakes, and he looked up on the piano, and there was a glass of water with a birth control device floating in it, which I will not name. Uniroyal puts them out. And it just really intrigued him. He just, you know, it would. And he said, ladies, said, look, I got to ask you this. He said, what
is that?
Lady said, I don't know. Said, we found it in the park last fall. And said, it said on the package, place on organ for prevention of disease. Said, we don't have an organ. Said, we put it up there on the piano. And says, you know, we haven't even had a cold all winter. Now, if you can't get that off the tape's not going to Hogansville, I can assure you. On July the 19th, 1971, I sat down one night and decided that I was an alcoholic, and I picked up the telephone book and looked in and found Alcoholics Anonymous under the A's. Took a shower, put on my best clothes, and got in my car and went down to Alcoholics Anonymous and shined up. Worked the 12 steps. Got a sponsor. Never had another problem. My wife and I fell madly in love. My children became perfect. I became extremely wealthy. I became a professional success. The police came to my house and said they forgave me. My probation was revoked. And if you believe that, let's all stand, join hands, and say the Lord's Prayer. Because that didn't happen. On July the 19th, 1971, I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for one reason. I didn't have anywhere else to go. I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because there was not one person in the world that would believe another lie that I told. There was nobody that would loan me a nickel. I couldn't con anybody. I couldn't lay a story upon anybody. I had no place to live. I was almost out of work. I was physically sick. I was an emotional wreck. I was financially bankrupt, spiritually totally devoid of any values. And my wife walked into the garage where I lived. I married a Baptist girl who believes that when you're married forever. God help her. Last Wednesday, we celebrated our 31st wedding anniversary. In 31 years, I won one argument. I'm just a heck of a lot smarter than she is. I am, folks. Anytime she wants to argue about that, all I have to do is say, look at who you married. I wouldn't have married anybody like she did. And if I had, I wouldn't have stayed with them. We had been together all those years. My wife hid me. She made excuses for me. She covered for me. She enabled me. She supported me. See, I wasn't a down and out drunk. I wasn't like you guys. We had a nice home. My wife and I bought it jointly. She used my VA loan and her money. And they kept me hid. I was not a bottomed-out drunk. I was not destitute. I used to take my socks off with a putty knife some, but that's just because I didn't like to bathe. And the only reason I didn't like to bathe is because I'd get in the shower, she'd hide my britches, and I couldn't get to the liquor store. If you ever run 3 miles to a liquor store at 9:10 with wet khaki britches on, you know what I mean. It's uncomfortable. You'll do it because, our disease creates a lot of uncomfort. discomfort. My wife was a very, very sick woman. I'm serious. I know as I stand here today, and you don't have to accept what I say, you know, you're just going home, we'll all clap and stand up and go home, we'll all get better. But I am convinced as I stand here this morning that this is a very serious family disease that is fatal to all people who catch it. And I believe that the Al-Anon, the Al-Ateen, the Al-Dog, the Al-Refrigerator, all these things that come in contact with the alcoholic suffer worse than the alcoholic does, but I don't know what they do with their suffering. I know what I did with mine. I medicated it. I treated it. My wife didn't have any release. She became a nag. She became a manipulator. She became an enabler. I didn't know all these words till I went in treatment. I went through a very fancy treatment center, folks, out in Dallas, Texas. It was $10 a week. You know. Now, Jack, I don't disagree with what you said. I mean, you know, I think that I went through one of them treatment centers, and it was great. If you stayed there 3 days, you got a bed. You slept on the floor in the shower the first 3 days, and you knew why, too. It just saved them a lot of trouble. You know, you puke, they turn it on. Now, my wife says that a man with my education should not use the word puke, but I don't know how to describe what I did any other way, you know. I mean, it would really be redundant for me to stand here and say to you, I barfed. Babies barf. You know, threw up. You throw up when you have the flu. Upchuck. I puked. I mean, I'm talking about toenail hairball type stuff. You know, I mean, puke. You know, and I was neat. You know, I mean, I could lay flat on my back and puke straight up, and not get any in my mustache. You know. So, you know, and I've always maintained that my wife was sicker than I was, and I'm not being facetious. She was. I'll give you an example. It's very obvious that because of my Moorism that I suffer from, that I have a weight problem. I have for years. And one time I asked my wife if she'd go to Weight Watchers for me. She went. Yeah. She lost 11 pounds, and I gained 17 pounds. And I said, honey, I don't think you ought to go down there anymore. This is not working for us, and she quit. So we had a sickness in our home, and everybody knew it but me. I lived in a little town called Irving, Texas, 104,000 people, and I was the last one there to find out I was an alcoholic. And my wife walked in to me one day on July the 19th, 1971, and says, we have inventoried you, said you have been audited. And I said, how did I make out? And she said, we found out that it cost us $500 a month more to keep you than you bring in. And we can't afford you anymore. Well, gosh, I didn't know things had gotten that bad, you know. And I asked to use her telephone. Because I didn't have one. I lived in the garage, and they won't put you a telephone in the garage unless you have one in the house, and I didn't have one in the house. And she let me use the telephone, and I called the Irving Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going into a drunkalogue. I drank all over Georgia. The reason I don't go into a drunkalogue is I'm kind of like Ted, you know. It would all be hearsay, and I don't believe what a lot of folks say I did. I just really don't, you know. I don't believe I was that bad. You know, I mean, I just didn't do things like that, a man of my caliber. Somebody asked me the other day, said, were you a social drinker? And I said, if you had any liquor, I was. You know, I'm like Ted, I don't understand social drinking. You know, I never drank with my daddy. My daddy lives up in Greenville. Right outside of Greenville, he's in Odessa Dale. I know y'all know where that is. And my daddy didn't know how to drink. My daddy'd buy a quart of liquor and put a top on it after you had a drink out of it. You know, he wouldn't even set it on the table. He'd pour you a drink and him a drink and put it up. He'd say, "You want a drink?" I said, "No, sir." Because that was honest to God truth, folks. I didn't want a drink. I wanted that bottle. You know, I wanted mine and his and all of it. I did, you know, but I would be very sociable if you had any liquor. So my wife let me use the phone, and I went in to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I was no stranger to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had called them many times. You see, in Irving, they have an electronic answering machine, and it says, "You have reached the Irving group of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no one here at this time." And I used to hang up. I found out years later that it also says if you have an immediate problem, it gives you 6 telephone numbers, see? There was an ad in the Irving paper every day. It said, "If you want to drink, that's your business." I did, and it was, and that's all I ever read. I found out later that it also said, "If you want to stop, that's our business." But I called the Irving group, and what I used to do is I'd get this electronic answering machine, and I would confess to it. Made my wife feel better. You know, I'd say, "Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, let me tell you what I've done today. I have stolen my children's lunch money again." And I'd begin to cry over the telephone. I was a good crier. God, if Melinda and I had ever got together, we could have washed out 3 counties, you know. I mean, I want you to know that, man, I could cry, you know. I had a Ray Charles album too, Ted, you know. The only thing was, I sang with him. I was a country and western star. I really believe I'd went to Nashville if I hadn't quit drinking when I did. It's quite a shock when I sobered up and found out I didn't know how to play that guitar that I'd had. And I called and I'd say, "Let me tell you all these terrible things I've done." My wife would listen. I was kind of like the Pharisees in the Bible. I would pray long and loud, make darn sure everybody in the block could hear me, and, you know. And then I'd go back and she'd say, "What did they say?" And I'd say, "They said I might not ought to drink bourbon for a while. It seems to be affecting my stomach and my nervous system. Maybe I ought to switch to vodka." And she believed that. She wanted to believe so bad. You know, she needed something to believe in, and she would try. So I called down this night, and I got a people on the phone. It was a terrible shock. You know, I called down there, and I got this people. I never cared much for people, because people will tell your wife where you've been when you disappear for 4 or 5 days, you know. People will send your checks back from the bank just because you don't have any money down there. Now, I don't know if there are any bankers in here or not. Chances are they are. I know a lot of bankers ought to be in here. And I'm convinced that all banking officers are alcoholic. I mean, they're crazy. I mean, why in the world would they charge you $12 of what they already know you ain't got when you write a bad check? You know, I never intentionally wrote a bad check in my life. I used to write checks and give them to the bartender and hope he'd die on the way to the bank. Maybe he'll lose that little bag. Just one time, let one of them things go through that computer. That's not much to ask out of life, is it? $3? You know, $3 one time through a computer, and I never got it. It was a story of my life. I never got a break. I got this people on the phone, and I said, "I want to talk to somebody about drinking." And he said, "Well, we're having a meeting. Come on down." And I said, "Well, can you come if you've been drinking?" And he said, "Well, most people have." And you see, I discovered an anatomical fact that the alcoholic has this propensity for hearing anything he wants to hear, regardless of what's been said. And I went in and got my gallon of Sweet Luce. And if you don't know Sweet Luce, she's my favorite girl. Went with her for years. And I poured out a glass, and my wife says, "What are you going to do now?" And I said, "The man said for me to have a drink and come on down there." I heard him. I said, can you come if you've been drinking? And he said, most people have. I didn't want to go different. So I got in my old car and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous at 1600 East Irving Boulevard, only I thought it was West, and I went to the wrong place. See, when I got there, it was gone. Didn't upset me. I didn't think it was that unusual. See, it wasn't the least bit unusual for me to call somebody and tell them I was coming and they'd be gone when I got there. It happened a lot. I went to a real estate sales meeting. Broke it up. They looked like alcoholics. I went back home. I never met an alcoholic in AA that looked like an alcoholic. Have you? I finally met one up in Oklahoma City about a year and a half ago, but she was an Al-Anon. Now, I want you to understand something right here at the outset. I love Al-Anon, and I tease you a lot, but I want you to know one thing. If it weren't for the program of Al-Anon, I probably wouldn't be here today. Because my wife got into the program the same day I came into AA, and she supported me a lot of times when I needed support. And she stopped supporting me when I didn't need it. I went back home because I thought everything would be fine, and I got home, and my wife had put everything I owned out on the front porch. She knew I wasn't going to AA. Of course, it all fit in one pillowcase. And I realized things were desperate, and I tapped on the door timidly and requested permission to use her phone again, and she allowed me to, and I called AA, and they were still there. I thought by this time they'd be gone, I could talk to that machine. They were still there talking about some drunk like, you know, what we do. And I said, well, look, I said, I got this problem. I'd like to talk to somebody about it. I said, could y'all come over here in 2 or 3 days? And God said, if you need some help, we'd be glad to come right now. I said, well, it's late. You know, I've always been very considerate. And I said, I know you guys got jobs, and I have one, too, because I hadn't been there in a while. I worked for the federal government. I worked for U.S. Public Health Service, and it was easier for them to keep me than it was to fire me. But in my case, they had decided to make the effort, and I was on probation. And so my wife was standing there, the kids were standing there, and I said, well, come on, and they did. And they said ridiculous things. You know, they came to my house, God. You know, two guys named James and John. Can you imagine, of all people, James? I thought Peter would show up any minute. And they sat down, and they said, they talk silly. You know, they talk dumb. They said, take it easy. Well, God, you couldn't take it much easier. And I was taking it, folks. I wasn't doing nothing, you know. They said, let go and let God. I didn't have a hold of anything, and if I did, God didn't want it. I can assure you. Yeah. And then one of them said, one day at a time. And he hit a bell. It struck a chord, and because that's where I drank. I never had enough whiskey to drink 2 days in a row. I drank every day, but I never had enough to plan 2 days, I want you to know. When I woke up in the morning, the first thing I'd do is look to see how much was left and then start planning how I could get more. Because, folks, it was hard. It was hard to come up with enough money to stay drunk 24 hours. I want you to know that it is hard. Where I never met a stupid alcoholic in my life, because you cannot survive as an alcoholic if you're stupid. It takes every bit of the ingenuity that you can come up with to support that habit 24 hours a day, folks. I want to move on. I could go into a lot of this. I don't want to. I just want to tell you that I wound up at AA. You know, I just love what they said. They said, you know, come on down here. You have 2 birthdays a year, and I like parties. I went down to AA and saw the 12 steps. And I thought the initiation was kind of rough. They said, all you got to do is take 12 steps on the wall. Well, you know, I've been off the wall several times. I went home and told my wife. She said, what do you think? I said, the initiation's rough. You got to take 12 steps on the wall. I didn't understand. They carried me to my first meeting. It was in Grand Prairie, Texas, and they drove up in front of a Lutheran church. I said, I knew it. You're all a bunch of fanatics. I'm not going in there. I wasn't sick. They said, well, we don't go into the sanctuary. We're going to meet over in the fellowship house. I'm not going in any of those buildings because that's where God lives. I knew about God. I had a deal with God. He took care of things at night while I slept, and I ran things in the daytime. And I want to tell you, at this particular period in my life, he wasn't doing a whole lot better with his part than I was mine. Things were a mess. I attended my first AA meeting sitting in a folding chair on Highway 80 in downtown Grand Prairie, Texas, the main highway going from Fort Worth to Dallas, right outside of Six Flags. 8-lane highway, and I sat on a sidewalk and listened through the window because I wouldn't go in a building where God lived. Heard ridiculous things. One guy got up, you know, and he said, I fell off a truck ramp and landed on my head and broke my leg. Oh. Another guy got up and said, I came to AA 9 months ago and said I didn't have a shirt or a parachute. I bet that guy had on $400 worth of clothes. And then that lady finally stood up I could identify with. I heard this lady the first 5 nights I was in AA, this same lady. Had a husband that was in prison. Had a daughter that was in a correctional home. She had another daughter that was pregnant, wasn't married. She had a son that had a brain tumor, and she was going into the hospital for a hemorrhoidectomy. And I thought, God, why don't somebody help her? She needs a drink. I've been drunk for a lot less than that. We went back to the AA group, and the Al-Anons had invited my house. I walked in, the first thing I saw, they had the wagon circle, folks, and they had my wife in the middle. And I got her out of there. We started home, and she said, do you know what they told me? And I said, no, what? She said, they told me I wasn't responsible for your drinking. I said, God, well, who is there but two of us that live over there? And I wasn't responsible. I had been told by judges, lawyers, doctors, Indian chiefs, policemen, my father, my mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, and strangers on the street that I was not responsible. You know, I started out up in LaGrange, Georgia at 18 years of age, standing before a judge who said to me, you're just sorry as hell. I was asked to leave LaGrange and I joined the Navy. I got to San Diego and I hadn't been there 3 days till the chief petty officer looked at me and said, son, you're just sorry as hell. Yeah. I married a beautiful lady from Kentucky, and I went home to visit her daddy, and it hadn't been there 2 days. He said, son, you sorry as hell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I became an undertaker. You know, I used to be a licensed funeral. I still have a licensed funeral director and embalmer. In fact, I was a lot better funeral director than I am a preacher. You know, a lot of times I get folks straightened out while I'm preaching and they get crooked again the next day, but when I straighten folks out as a funeral director, they stay straight. So I want you to know something that I heard this story, folks, until by the time I was 24 years old, I decided that if I was sorry, I was going to be as sorry as there was. I mean, if the only thing you got going for you is sorry, then you got to excel at something. Everybody has to excel at something. And I decided that I'd just be sorry. I didn't decide to be an alcoholic. I don't remember a day when I ever sat down and said, I think I'll screw my head up the rest of my life. I really don't ever remember planning a career in alcoholism. I just decided that if I was going to be sorry, I'd just be sorry. And at 38 years of age in 1971, I reached it. Started out up in LaGrange, Georgia with a fellow there in Winford. You know him well, Shine. We called him Shine, and it wasn't because he had a bright face. And I used to look at Shine and say, if I ever got like that, I'd quit. I woke up in the cell one Sunday morning with Shine. And I said, Shine, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he said, no. He pointed at a fellow named Yank. You might remember Yank. And Yank was laying across the hall over there. He'd puked all over himself and looked terrible. I hadn't puked on but one side. I looked better than he did. You see, there is a hierarchy in jail, too, you know. And he said, that's an alcoholic. And I said, yeah, if I ever got like that, I'd quit. I woke up under a mulberry tree down on Peachtree Street there in the Grange by the Confederate Cemetery one Sunday morning with Yank Hyde laying beside me dead. He had frozen to death during the night. He didn't have a coat. I did. I remember thinking, boy, if I got that dead, I'd quit. I almost did. I left LaGrange. I joined the Navy. Met my wife in the Navy and became a succession of 18 years of looking for people that I could look down on and say, boy, if I ever got like that, I'd quit. Till finally, on July the 19th, 1971, the whole world was looking down on me and saying, if I got like that, I'd quit. There was nobody else to look down on. That's what I believe bottom means, folks. You know, we all have our opinions, but I believe bottom is when you can no longer find anybody else to get worse than. So I came to AA. Sat down there in those meetings. Became speaker. Became an expert. Got a big book. Stole it. Man told me to. Joe DeWitt from Chattanooga, Tennessee, spoke at the intergroup meeting in Dallas. I'd been in AA 3 days. He said, if you haven't got a big book, steal one. I didn't know what a big book was, but I went back to the group and stole one. Yeah. And I wasted hours and hours and hours in them dumb old discussion meetings. Sitting there waiting for my turn to speak. Thinking about what I was going to say. And then when my turn came, I would say it and I'd spend the rest of the hour thinking about what I had said. And folks, if you don't get any more out of A and what you bring down here, you got a problem because you didn't have anything to start with. You wouldn't be here. One night the magic word happened, a magic thing. Guy walked in, everybody jumped up, run over, hugged his neck, kissed him, blew in his ear, run their fingers through his hair. You know, I thought Bill W. was out. I said, who is that? Said, oh, he's had a slip. What's that? Well, he's been out experimenting. And he's come back. God. I found the AA program. You go out and get drunk and come back and everybody love you. Nobody been kissing me in the ear and running their finger through my hair. I'll tell you what, the first year I was in AA, I never had any trouble getting a seat. Because when I sat down, two people moved. I want you to know, folks, I didn't come in AA wearing no black three-piece suit. I came in kind of nasty. I just didn't bathe much. I latched onto the word slip. You see, what I thought a slip was is I'd be coming down the road one day and I'd suddenly come drunk. And then I could stay drunk as long as I wanted to and nobody could blame me. So all I ever really wanted to do was drink with dignity. And so for about 2 weeks, every night, every time we'd have a meeting, somebody would say, anybody have anything you want to discuss? And I'd say, let's talk about slips. Finally, a little fella came up to me one night, boy, about 90 pounds, had glaucoma, had glasses that thick, about this tall. He came up to me and he said, Ray, could I see you in the Al-Anon room? He had about 13, 14 years sobriety. I thought he had a problem. So we went over into the Al-Anon room and little Paul looked up at me and he's squinting through those thick glasses and he said, Ray, I've been in this program almost 14 years and you're without a doubt the phoniest SOB we've ever had here. Yeah. I want to tell you something. I did what any other self-respecting alcoholic would do. I quit. I went home. I'm drinking buttermilk, taking Jagosil, eating Maalox tablets, smoking cigarettes, drinking that Louisiana coffee, pacing the floor, kicking the walls, feeling sorry for myself. And my lovely wife, who has this irritating habit of being totally logical where I'm concerned, says to me, well, what happened? And I said, I told her what Paul had said. She said, why do you think he said that? I said, I don't think he likes me. And she said, nobody does, but they don't go around and tell you stuff like that. So I called Paul, 2 o'clock in the morning. I said, Paul, why'd you do that to me? And Paul said something to me. He said, we don't have anything to share in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I experienced strength and hope. And he said, I've had the experience you're hoping to have, and I hope to share it by sharing it with you. You wouldn't have to experience it. But he said, if you want to, go ahead. He said, well, let me tell you what it'd be like. He said, you'll have to decide to get some whiskey. And he said, I bet if the truth were known, you've already done that. And that really irritated me. I didn't know how he knew that. I had a pint of whiskey in the trunk of my car. I was saving for a poor, sick, suffering alcoholic. Me. And Paul said, well, you have talked so much in AA, and you've made such a pest of yourself. He said, you could never, ever drink in front of anybody again. You'll have to make a decision to find a place to drink. Then you'll have to make a decision to go to that place. You'll have to make a decision to take the whiskey out of your hiding place. You'll have to make a decision to take the top off the bottle. You'll have to make a decision to turn it up. And even after you get it in your mouth, he said, you're going to have to decide whether or not to swallow. And then if you're ever fortunate enough to walk into another AA group and you have no promise that you ever will, you'll have to look at those people and say, I got drunk because I wanted to be drunk more than I wanted to be sober, because that's the only reason there is. And I hated him. He stole my slip. I never did have it yet. I went on back down there. Thank you. So I went on back down to AA, and I got me a 12 and 12, and I got me a notebook, and I worked the 12 steps, and I began to make 12 step calls, and I became the spokesman for the group. Went home, my wife and I fell madly in love, paid off all my debts, got a good job, never had any more problems. My kids do everything I tell them to, and I've never, ever again had a burden. Do I detect disbelief? I went back to AA and sat down over in the corner and swelled up and didn't drink. That's what you said, Ted. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Well, I couldn't drink. He stole my slip, and the judge made me go to meetings. I didn't have to go to meetings. I want you to understand that. You know, everybody has a choice. But I have never seen a meeting so bad that I'd rather be in jail. Now, I just got to tell you that. I've been in some pretty bad AA meetings, but I've never seen one that I'd rather be in jail. So I went to the meetings. I went every day. Every day I went to the meetings, 7 days a week, sometimes 2 and 3 times a day, because we had meetings. I lived in the Dallas area. I sat there, and I listened, and I talked. One day I got a sponsor. A fellow named Al came up to me. He said, I'm your sponsor. I said, I haven't chosen the sponsor yet. He said, yes, you have, and I'm him. I said, I thought you got to choose your own sponsor. He said, you do, you did, and I'm him. I said, well, I'm undecided about sponsorship. He said, you don't understand, do you? We matched, and I lost. Yeah. I want you to understand something, folks. Now, I don't care, and I'm not saying anything. You know, I'm not one of these old bleeding deacons. You know, I'm getting to be a mossback. I want you to understand that, because I'm fundamental about AA, and don't mess with my program. You know, there's two basic things you're going to have to do to prove to me you're serious about this. Number one, if you want to be an alcoholic, you got to drink liquor. You got to drink some kind of alcohol. We got this modern movement abroad today, folks just won't be in here and get what we got. But I want you to understand one thing. You won't be an alcoholic. You got to drink alcohol. Now, I'm not saying anything at all against you, cross-addicted, you know, double-dip addicts. I mean, you're welcome as you can be. But what I want you to understand is don't call yourself alcoholic unless you drink alcohol. You know, it's all right. You can if you want to. I don't care. But the second thing is, and it's very fundamental, if you want to be an AA, you got to quit.
Because I've been in AA 22 years, and so this never have got a hang on it.
I know what he's hanging on to. And I don't want him to put his hand in mine until he gets it clean. But I want you to understand, you know, one, if you want to be an alcoholic, you got to drink alcohol. Now, I'm not a purist. I don't believe that you're going to be a pure alcoholic. I never met a pure alcoholic. I drank with some awful nasty ones, folks. But what I'm simply saying is, if you're going to be an alcoholic, you got to drink alcohol. If you want to be an AA, you got to quit. And that's just that simple. But see, in those early days, I didn't get into any of that stuff. I just sat there. I went to meetings. I carried a big book. I wore out a big book carrying it to me. Never did read it. Nobody ever said to me, you know, get in here, here's the answer. You know, I thought, well, I'm going to come down here and eventually I'm going to be like everybody else. And you know, I got to tell you something, folks. For a long time, I was like nearly everybody else because we had a room full of people doing the same thing. One night I was sitting in a beginner's meeting. I don't know if you've ever been to a beginner's meeting, but they're great. In Irving, we had a beginner's meeting every Saturday night at 7 o'clock so that we could get the BS out of the room and have a real meeting at 8 o'clock. And the beginner's meeting, I was chairman. And the beginner's meeting goes something like this, folks. First man says, I used to drink shoe polish. The next man said, that ain't nothing. I used to drink kerosene. Lit. You know, the next man says, I got drunk one time in Memphis and woke up in Nashville. Next guy said, that ain't nothing. I got drunk one time in Hong Kong and woke up in Quebec, Canada, in my car. Next guy says, I've been married 9 times. Next guy said, that's nothing. I've been married 3 times since lunch. Twice to my sister. And I'm sitting there waiting for my turn. Yeah. Now, they always had an old bleeding deacon that sat in on these. A fellow named Curly had 27 years of sobriety, and I hated his literal guts. Now, I know you've said, I hate somebody's guts, but I'm talking about, you know, I want to open his belly up and just hate his guts. I mean, right up close. Because I hated Curly. He said the silliest, dumbest thing. He said, it'll pass. My grandma said that when I eat prunes. That didn't always happen either. Curly had this irritating habit of asking the group questions and looking straight at me. And I had the stupid habit of answering him. Curly said, I want to ask you men a question. He said, any of you ever been so drunk you didn't remember what you did? And I said, of course, because that's point of honor with an alcoholic. He said, I'd like to ask you another question. He said, you ever woke up in the bed with a 95-year-old woman with sores all over her body? And I said, no. He said, how do you know? We've all heard the phrase, God works in mysterious ways. But I want you to understand something. That remark put me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked out of that room that night, and I walked to Al's house about 4 blocks away. I rang the doorbell. He came to the door, standing, big tears running down my face. He said, what's the matter? And I said, I've just found out a terrible thing. He said, what's that? I said, I don't know what I've done. He said, none of us do. I said, the heck with you. I'm talking about me. You know, this program got personal for me real fast. He said, what does that mean? And I said, it means I can never look down my nose at anybody else. Because I don't know what I've done. It means I can never be judgmental again because I don't know what I've done. And old Al reached out, got me by the arm, and he said, it just might be that you're ready to take certain steps. He said, what are the three meanings of AA? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous, absolute abstinence, and admitted and accepted that we're powerless over alcohol. You see, I admitted it. I wasn't a problem. I took step one that first day. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know. I went down to the sheriff's office and I said, Sheriff Decker, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. He said, yeah, I know that, but you're still going to joint if you don't pay the checks off. Mm-hmm. I went to see my boss. I said, Dr. Alexander, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. He said, yeah, we all know that. But he said, you know, your probation's up Friday. You're fired. I went home. I told my wife. I said, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. And she said, I'm still going to get a divorce. I went back to AA and I said, it doesn't work. I took step one and nobody cares. But you see, when I got serious about the program, when the program became personal, when the program became life and death, I suddenly realized and accepted the fact I really was powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Al said there are two tools that every alcoholic has to have to maintain his lifestyle. Rationalization and justification, and as long as the alcoholic can justify what he's about to do and rationalize away what he's already done, he'll probably continue doing it. Didn't understand that real well for a while. One morning I was sitting in a meeting in Arlington, Texas. The phone rang and the guy motioned for me to pick up the extension. There was a lady on the phone. She said, I'm drunk. You ever notice how we love to call people and do that? I thank God they didn't invent direct dialing before I sobered up. I'd be a pauper today. I used to call people in California, you know. If I'm drunk, they never were impressed. The guy said, I'm sorry, you're drunk. Said, you were doing so well. Said, you got almost a year's sobriety. She said, well, I want to tell you why. We like to do that too. She said, it's the peanut butter. He said, lady, I don't understand. You got drunk on peanut butter? She said, no. I said, we don't have any peanut butter. Said, my husband came home and threw a fit because we didn't have any peanut butter. And I went down to the 7-Eleven and bought 2 6-packs of beer and drank all 12 of them. He said, lady, wouldn't it have been simpler to have bought a jar of peanut butter? She said, to hell with him. I don't care if you don't ever get no more peanut butter. You see, we laugh. We sit here today and we laugh about that. But let me ask you this. How many times did you deliberately start a fight so you could slam out the door and go get drunk? How many times did you deliberately come home and start an argument so you could go and be justified in getting drunk? How many times did you ever say to your wife or your husband, look, I'm feeling a little down. I'm itchy. I got this hole in my belly. The wind's blowing through it. I just really got to tell you, I'm coming unwired. I feel like I want to get on my horse and ride off in all four directions. I think I'll just go screw my brain up for a while. Now, I'm going to sleep with two or three folks while I'm gone. I probably have a fight or two. Certainly going to disgrace us in the neighborhood, going to blow every dime in you got, and I'll probably be in jail or the hospital by the end of the week. How many times did you do that? Yeah, sure you did. Well, honey, I'm going to stop off and have a drink on the way home. You never stopped off and had one of anything in your life. If you didn't die after that first one, you stayed. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable, and we believe that. We accept that as absolute gospel fact. And folks, if you don't believe that, you might well go home. Because you cannot be in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous till you do that. And I agree with Ted. You know, you don't do step one, two, and three. They are accepted. They're there. You know? He said, what's step two? I said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. He said, you got any problem with that? I said, uh-uh. I had already believed in God. I believed in God all my life. I was scared to be an agnostic just in case. You know, I wasn't stupid. You know, I always thought it's going to be ridiculous to, you know, someday be standing there and there he is and say, well, I don't believe in you. You know, that's like driving a Lincoln Continental said you don't believe in Ford factories. You know, I mean, the evidence is all around you.
I never troubled all the stuff too, folks. I want you to know one thing. I was glad to know I was insane. I thought I was sorry as hell. Now, I want to tell you something. Every December in Hogansville, Georgia, we get 3 truckloads of stuff together and send it down to Georgia Regional Center there in Columbus, you know, for the people who have mental problems. We ain't never sent nothing to folks as sorry as hell. You know? I felt like I was among an elite group, you know, I was sick. You know, I just really didn't. My wife used to say, I'd say, honey, don't let the neighbors know I've been drinking. She said, well, how must I explain you being naked out in the yard? I said, tell them I'm sick. I didn't know it, but I was. You know? Step 3, you know, I gotta tell you, I want to get over in the corner and cover my face and just giggle when I hear alcoholics talk about step 3. I tipped step 3 today. Hogwash. Double dip, chocolate covered bologna. Can't you just see an alcoholic, you know, wrapping himself in paper and putting a bow on himself and laying himself out on the yard and say, God, here it is. Come get it. I turned it over. Oh, baloney. Let me tell you something, folks. When you reach the point where you're no longer the center of the universe and you know that other people have feelings and somebody else is running things, step 3's already done. I hate religion. I really do. If I could ever get what we got here into the church, Billy Graham would have a problem, brother. I want you to know something. You know, if I could get folks to understand just one time the difference between religion and spirituality. See, religion is God's feeble attempt to impress, is man's feeble attempt to impress God with what he knows. And spirituality is accepting from God what he wants you to have. It's that simple. Thank you. I did an inventory, 4-step inventory wasn't any trouble at all for me. I just want you to understand that. I bought me a ream of paper, 2 dozen Bic pens, a carton of Winston cigarettes, a pound of Louisiana coffee. Yeah. And I sat down there and waited for God to reveal to me my inventory. 4 hours later, my back hurts. My fanny's cramped. My paper's blank. And I didn't get no revelation. I believe God knows who's hard-headed and who's stubborn and who's stupid. And Ted, this is no reflection. But I had a fellow in prison. He was in the federal prison in Segoville, Texas, and I trusted him because he couldn't get out and tell nobody nothing. And I went over to see him, and I said, I'm having trouble with step 4. And he said, step 4, ain't nothing to that. He said, you got any paper? I said, yeah, I got this big old ream here. He said, I don't need one page. He said, you got a pencil? I said, yeah. He said, okay, sit down right here, draw a line down the middle. On one side, write good. On the other side, write bad. Now, on the good side, he said, I want you to write this. There's nothing wrong with me. I already knew that. It was embarrassing. I couldn't write it, but I knew it. But see, if he said it was all right, so I wrote, there's nothing wrong with me. And then he said, on the other side, write, I'm a dad-burned liar. And I did. And he said, now take that and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12 and go home and finish your inventory. I said, well, you're going to tell me how to do it? He said, I just did. Take the paper, the pencil, the big book, the 12 and 12 and go home and do your inventory. He said, I'll take your inventory if you want me to. He said, in fact, I think I just will take your inventory. He said, you're egotistical, self-centered, selfish, self-righteous. Said, you're not at all what you think you are, and you ain't never going to be what you want to be. Said, you're going to have to accept what God gives you. Whew. I decided to go home and take my own inventory. I didn't like his. And I went home, and I did basically what Ted said last night. You know, I put down, I hate so-and-so. Why? Because they did this. How does it affect me this way? What am I going to do about it? This. And then I came to step 5, and my sponsor said, look, time for you to take step 5. And I said, I got that all figured out. I've called Houston, Texas. I called the intergroup. Told them to send me a drunk to Huntsville and I was going to meet him, and we were going to swap Fifth Steps. Huntsville's halfway between Dallas and Houston, in case you don't know that. They hung up on me. I said, well, Al said, now what you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to buy me a bottle of wine. I'm going down on South Harwood Street and get me a wine order, and I'm going to tell him about it. He said, no, you're not. He said, get step five. And he said, get your inventory. And I got it. He said, come on in here. And we went in the Al-Anon room. He closed the door. He said, now tell me about this stuff. I said, you want all these details? He said, it don't say that. He said, the exact nature of your own. He said, I don't care who you done and what you done it with. You know? And that's what he said, who you done and what you done it with. I thought he'd made a mistake, but he's right. Do you know something? He yawned during my fifth spell. I mean, God, you know, I mean, I'm convinced, you know, that I'm going to go take a fifth step, and they're going to say, well, look, we take all the queers and the perverts and all this other, pardon me if there's any of you here that are offended by that, I'll withdraw that, any gays. And, you know, I knew they'd take the scum of the earth, but I knew when I did step five, they're going to say, but we draw the line at you. I found out, so I have not developed one single original fault. I wasn't even good at some of the ones I did. I just like everybody else. I just average, you know. You know, to tell you the truth about it, I've been accused of more and got less than anybody in the whole world. I was a little disappointed in me when I did my fifth. I said, now what I want you to do, I want you to go out by yourself. I want you to think about what you've done. And I want you to know, folks, that one of the best things that ever happened to me in AA was completing step five. Because I sat down under a tree and came to the full realization, I don't have to be scared anymore. Somebody already knows. I don't have to hide anything. And my big book says, you will find there will be a newfound freedom. I didn't understand that gobbledygook until that day. I got up from that tree. And I look at people as I walk down the street and I say, I don't have to be afraid of you. Somebody came up to me that day and said, did you know so-and-so's talking about you? I said, I don't care. You really don't care if people talk about you? I said, not a bit. What if they knew what I know? They could really tell some stuff. If they're telling something that's true, no big deal. If it's a lie, who cares? Step six got a little complicated. I'm running out of time. I don't mean to keep you, but we were entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character, really. Yeah. I didn't have any defects of character, to tell you the truth, but I don't have one. I had a temper. That was all. Came home from work one day, my son was lowering the wheels on the lawnmower. I'm totally unmechanical. You know, I just found out the other day that a light bulb screws both ways. I'm a Christian psychologist. You know how many psychologists it takes to change a light bulb? Just takes one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. So I come home, you know, and my son lowering the wheels on this lawnmower, and he got a vice grip pliers in one hand, a fit-all wrench on the other, and he got this little sledgehammer, and he got three wheels lowered down, and one is stuck. And I came in and said, let me do that. I grabbed this thing, you know, and I whip, and the wrench comes loose. My hand goes into the lawnmower blade, peels the meat back off my knuckle. And you don't think I got upset. I just picked up that little hammer and beat the motor slap off that lawnmower. And I looked up, and my wife and my daughter are standing in the door of the utility room, and she said, well, good afternoon, Mr. Serenity. And I said, I'm not going to let this thing upset me. And I threw that hammer through the garage door. And then I got in my car and I went down to the department store and I paid $99 for a lawnmower. On the way home, I stopped and paid $139 for a replacement garage door. And I suddenly realized I couldn't afford a temper. Yeah. As they become a problem, we become willing for God to remove them. As they make us sick, we begin to become willing to turn them loose. God doesn't take anything away from you. You're not willing to turn loose.
A guy told me the other day, he said, God's going to heal me from alcoholism. I said, he won't do it as long as you go to the liquor store every morning and buy some whiskey. I don't believe that. Never seen any evidence that God does things for us that we could do for ourselves. Step 7, we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. You do the asking, let God do the removing. We want to do it backward. You know, we want to stand on a box and say, God, do this. Humbly, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. You do the asking, but only God can do the removing.
God told me, he said, I gave up smoking.
Who did he give it to? You gotta, you know, who wants it? I don't smoke. I quit smoking 10 years ago. It became a sin that day. Fifteen years ago, on July the 20th, 1971, alcohol became one of the 8 deadly sins. That's when I had my last drink. And I'm gradually giving up lust. I believe 20 more years I'm going to have her. 8 and 9, real quick. Made a list of all the people. Boy, yeah, I made me a list, you know. There was one guy that lived up in LaGrange that I stole some money from, and he took my house away from him. I thought we was eating, so I didn't put him on the list. I went around, made my amends, made my list, made my amends, all except for this one guy. And you know something? The strangest thing happened. Now, folks, you know, I'm not talking mysticism here. I'm talking about AA. Every time I'd go to a meeting, if it was a closed meeting, they talked about step 9. If we had a speaker meeting, some dumb guy'd come from the other side of the county over and talk about step 9. And that's all they ever wanted to talk about was step 9. And so I had this little thing that I did in those days. I'd go home, go to bed, and stay 3 or 4 days. First year I was in AA, I was in the hospital 8 times. See, back in those days when you had Blue Cross, you'd go to the hospital, they'd treat you nice 2 or 3 days. They found out there wasn't nothing wrong with you. I liked that attention. But I done used up all my hospitalization. I'd just go home, get in the bed, and cover my head up and stay there, see. I laid there about 3 or 4 days, and one day I looked up, and Al was standing in the bedroom. He said, get up. And I said, I'm sick. He said, the whole world knows that. Get up. So I went in the dining room. There sat my wife, my son, my daughter, and Al. And they were going to have roast me. And we had one of those famous AA meetings that we have, or Al-Anon, whatever you want to call them, you know, and Al said, look, said, your problem is that you got somebody in your life that you owe something to that you have not made amends to, and it's going to get you. And I said, Al, I can't go back there and tell that man what I've done. I said, he put me in jail. He said, you'd be better off sober in jail than you would drunk on the street. And I said, I just don't know if I can do it. My little 16-year-old son said, Daddy, I'll go with you. We drove back to LaGrange, and I went to the place, and office was upstairs. I went up, and the man got up, shook my hand. He said, Race, I've been hearing good things about you. Said, I talked to your dad the other day. Said, I understand you're doing something about your drinking problem. He said, I'm glad that things are working out for you and your family. He said, we don't want anything but the best for you. And I said, well, you're probably not going to be as happy about this when I tell you what I've come to tell you. He opened the file cabinet, pulled out a ledger, opened it up, big paper clip on one page. He said, is this what you're talking about? He'd known it all the time. I said, well, I don't know how I'm going to pay you. He said, forget it. It was just $5,000. He said, I've already written it off. Don't worry about it. I don't need it. You just take care of your life. Boy, I was on cloud 9. I went downstairs, got in the car, and my boy was sitting there, and he said, Daddy, how'd it go? I said, well, got it all done. He said, what'd he say, Daddy? I said, he told me that I was forgiven. Well, this program works. I said, he told me I was forgiven. He said, Dad, what about the money? I said, that's part of forgiving. You know, forgive us our debts. That's what the Bible says. I knew that scripture, Bill. I'm a WH. I whip that stuff out there, you know. My wife doesn't understand that.
See, she don't have a seminary education like I do. She doesn't understand that when she wants something, we can't afford it, and when I want something, God's leading us in that direction. I said, son, he told me forget about the money. He said he didn't need it, and it was written off. And he said, Daddy, you can't do that. I said, well, I can't pay him. He said, Daddy, all your life, you've made it a practice to try to get something for nothing. And if you get away with this, he said, it won't be long till you'll do it again. And I crawled out of that car and went back up those steps. And I made arrangements to pay that money. My little boy, 6'5", 240 pounds. And my daughter bussed tables in the cafeteria. My son pulled parts after school in a Caterpillar dealership, and my wife worked at the hospital. And it took us 18 months pooling our money to pay off Daddy's debt. But we grew together every day. We grew stronger as a family every day. On the way back to Texas, we got to Jackson, Mississippi. We'd lived there a couple of days one time. And my son pulled off the interstate, and I said, why are we getting off here? He said, Daddy, there's a man here you owe some money to also. I said, I don't have any money. He said, Mama, give me a check. And she said, if you did the right thing in Georgia, we would have stopped and paid this man in Mississippi, but if you didn't, it wouldn't make any difference. See, we got close a lot of time. You know about 10, 11, and 12, they're maintenance steps. But I want to take just a minute to tell you what happened. I worked step 9. Nothing happened. I wasn't a book man, Ted. I became a book toter. Boy, I'd whoop that thing on you. I could quote it, didn't know what it meant, but boy, I could give it to you. And the folks at the group began to irritate me. They were happy. They laughed. They played bingo, and that's gambling. Yeah, they danced on Saturday night. And they played with my program. It was not serious. And I'd sit over in the corner and look at them. And I'd think, you'll all be drunk. Because you're not serious about this the way I am. One Saturday afternoon, I was sitting in the group, and they were setting up for bingo. And I began to look around the room. They were laughing and cutting up and having the best time. And I'm sitting over there, you know. I look like anybody sitting in a bar, you know, that's run out of money. That's what I look like. And it suddenly dawned on me about 2/3 of those people hadn't been there nearly as long as I had, and here they were giggling and laughing. And I felt cheated. And I went down to Al's office, and I walked in, and I said, Al, the only thing that you've ever done, Al, sorry, dirt, I want you to know it. It's the meanest man ever walked. I've made a career out of trying to get him to say one time what a good job I'm doing in AA, and the kindest thing he's ever said is, I don't think you're going to make it. That was last November. And I went into Al's office, and I said, Al, you've never lied to me, and I want to ask you one thing. When is something good going to happen to me? I said, when am I going to be happy? And he looked at me, and he said, Ray, where do you sleep? And I said, I sleep in the master bedroom over in my house in Northwest Park. He said, huh. How are your children, Ray? I said, we got so many kids hanging around. Sometimes I have to go to the service station to use the restroom. He said, huh, how are things at work, Ray? I said, well, I've been promoted. I'm head of the department. He said, huh. How did you get down here today, Ray? I said, my new car. He said, huh. And then he looked at me and he said, Ray, I hope you stay around AA long enough for something good to happen to you. And I walked out of Al's office and I went back down to my little pecan tree in the park where I'd gone on my fifth step day. And I sat there and I guess the people passing by must have thought I was crazy. Because I sat there for about 3 hours and cried. And I thought back to the night they carried me to AA. Yeah, they come back and got me the next night and took me to the Fabulous Rehab Center. And my little boy went up to the phone booth. I never know why he went there, but he went and he took the change out of his pocket and called his grandmother in Kentucky. And when she answered, all he could say was, Mom, my daddy don't drink no more. I thought about being invited to the voice recital. It was my daughter. She's a coloratura soprano. And she sang in 5 languages. And I didn't even know she could sing. I thought about the night that my son graduated from high school. And he graduated in Irving Stadium where the Cowboys play. And I looked around that stadium and 10,000 people there who had been expecting to be there for 4 years. And I was there because I had been invited by a son who was no longer ashamed or afraid of his daddy. Thought about the next year. When my daughter graduated, she was valedictorian of her class, and she brought all of her friends by, and she said, this is my daddy. And we're proud of him. I thought about my son, who by this time was in the Air Force in Germany, and he was a radio operator, and he used to call me on the Mars hookup. And everybody with a shortwave radio from Texas to Germany could hear us, and he'd say, Daddy, I just want to call and tell you, I loved you, and I'm still so proud of you. Thought about my mother-in-law. She never knew what an alcoholic was, but she was dying with cancer, and she'd call me up and she'd say, Ray, I'm praying for you every day. Real quick, let me tell you what happened. Sitting in my bedroom one afternoon, I was reading the big book and the Bible at the same time. That's dangerous. I looked down, and the Bible was open to the 9th chapter of the book of Acts, which is St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. And I looked over, and it said, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I looked back over here, and he said, we took this guy and made this out of him. I looked back over here, and said, we turned our house over me. I got up, and I walked into the bedroom, into the den where my wife was sitting. I said, I think God's called me to preach. And she said, what and to who? And then she said to me, she said, if God's called you to preach, I've been through hell with you. She said, if they're going to be in heaven, I'm going to get part of that too. And she said, if God's called you to preach, she said, I think you ought to go to school. And I said, I don't believe that being an alcoholic prepares you to be a preacher or a counselor any more than having your appendix out qualifies you for surgery. You know, I mean, you're going to be this, folks. You better prepare because you're taking folks' life in your hands. Somebody came in the other day, said, been in AA 4 weeks, said, I'm going to be a counselor. I said, that's great. How long did it take? I said, 9 years. And now I'm learning. I went to Southwestern Seminary. I want to tell you right quick about that. Everything's right quick. I'm kind of like that black preacher, you know, who kept saying, and finally one of the deacons says, but not immediately. You know? I found out the next class started at Southwestern Seminary on Thursday. This is Sunday. I ran over there Monday morning and put in my application. They said it takes 2 months to get this cleared. I said, anyway, I can expedite it. They said, well, you can walk it through. And so I got accepted that day to Southwestern Seminary. Oh, it was just one little problem. I had money. I went down and resigned the job. They released me. I didn't have to work a notice or anything. I called a friend of mine in the real estate business. I said, I want to sell my house. 10 o'clock Monday morning. She said, well, we'll put it on the market, but things are slow right now. I said, you don't understand. I got to sell my house this week. I'm going to seminary. She said, you're crazy. I said, well, maybe, but talk to God about it, because, you know, it's kind of out of my hand. She said, well, I'll see what I can do at 12 o'clock that day. She called me back. She said, well, I think I got a buyer. I said, I forgot to tell you, I want cash. She said, is anything else? I said, yeah, I'm going to sell it furnished. 12:30, she called me back. She found a couple that moved down from Ohio. They were in their mid-40s. They just sold their home, and we signed the papers on our house that day and sold it fully furnished, cash money. And Thursday morning, we walked out of Irving, Texas, got in my little Datsun automobile. We had a king-size bed, a color TV, and a secondhand Datsun automobile, and I went to preach. They got a job at South Texas Children's Home. I went to the seminary. I prepared myself. I graduated over Southwestern Seminary, and I come out. I had an Oral Roberts haircut. I had a Billy Graham suit. Had on Pat Robinson shoes and an autographed Jim Baker Bible. And I'm ready to go forth. I'm going to conquer the world for the Lord. And you know what? There wasn't nobody out there. Strange, Bill. You know, I asked the same thing you told me. Yes, you know, I said, now, God, you called me to preach. Who am I going to preach to? And he said to me, you know, I know that kind of puts a cold chill, you know. You know, he didn't come down and sit down at the table. He just made it plain that I'll take care of that. You take care of the preparation. We moved down to a little town called Beeville, Texas, where Faye was working at South Texas Children's Home. I was getting real itchy. I went and started going to the Beeville AA group, and I was really getting itchy about this preaching thing. And so one afternoon, I told Faye, I said, I'm just coming apart at the scene. She said, go to AA. I said, won't be anybody there. She said, well, you need to be there. And I went down and I opened the door, and there was one little old man sitting over in the corner. I went over and made a pot of coffee, and he came over and he stuck his hand out and he said, I'm Carr P. And I said, I'm Ray Vowell. And he said, what do you do, Ray? And I said, I'm a Baptist preacher. And he said, do you have a church? I said, no, I'm at large. And the strangest thing happened. Carr P. began to cry. Tears began to run down his face. And he said, my brother-in-law is pastor at Calvary Baptist Church, and he's had a heart attack. He can't preach anymore. And he said, I had come down here today to pray that God would just send us a good pastor. And we got in his car, and he took me over and introduced me to the deacons. We went to 7 different houses that afternoon. The next Sunday, I preached at Calvary Baptist Church. And that afternoon, they voted unanimously to call me as the pastor, and I stayed there 5.5 years. Five years ago, I told Faye I'd like to go back to school. And I said, I really feel that I have a forte for counseling, but I don't feel prepared to do it. And I'd like to get my doctorate. And she said, why don't you? And I said, well, I'd be 50 years old before I finish. That was 6 years ago. She said, well, in 4 years, you're going to be 50 either way. On January the 2nd, 1984, I turned 50. On May the 14th, 1984, I received my PhD in Christian psychology. And on October the 15th, 1984, our daughter presented us with the most perfect, absolutely intelligent, little red-headed grandson who looks just like his grandfather and calls me Pawpaw and can just get anything I got. And if it were not for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would never have seen any of these, I'm convinced. My program, I try to keep it as simple as possible, and it consists basically of two very, very simple things. Number one, I know which drink makes me drunk. The first one. And number two, I know who, with God's help, has the choice over whether or not I take it. I thank you.